I like doing listener questions. It's fun.
I do too. Because now we're interacting with them instead of just each other. And, you know, well,
now we know we have listeners.
You're listening to the Help Me With HIPAA podcast, where HIPAA and humor collide to make learning fun. Your delightful hosts are Donna Grindle and David Sims. Relax. HIPAA help is on the way.
Welcome to the Help Me With HIPAA podcast. My name is David Sims of HIPAA for MSPs, and joining me is Donna Grindle of Cardin Compliance. How's it going, Donna?
It's going nice and quiet for a Friday.
Yeah, so far. You know, last Friday.
Insane!
We had to deal with a lot. And we, you know, the whole want to cry stuff was happening.
Well, hey, you've been whining a lot this week. You know,
I have been crying. I know, yes.
Yeah. I had dinner with friends this week, and one's a principal at a school, and the other runs an IT company. And it was funny because the principal's freaking out about all this stuff that's happening at the school system and is totally unaware about WannaCry. And the IT is totally freaking out about WannaCry and unaware of what's happening at the school system. And it was Saturday before they both went, wait, what are you working on? What's your problem?
Yeah. I mean, for us, I mean, unfortunately, we had no clients that got hit by it. But the problem is that it brought up some vulnerabilities and some things that IT people haven't looked at, you know, all across the board, not just me. And so we had to go in and do a whole lot of manual stuff looking at things that weren't issues before and disabling things that we didn't have to worry about before. And it's just been a massive, massive, massive amount of work. And even though we didn't have many phone calls come in, just the amount of work that we've had to do this past week is just insane. And that's one thing that clients don't realize is like, hey, we hadn't heard from the IT guy, you know, in 2 or 3 weeks. They don't realize that we're still doing 120 hours worth of work on their systems, and you know, they didn't hear a word from us.
Well, yeah, even the few that we still do, we took the time to go verify everything was in place, because you do have to do that. You know, you want to go be sure that everything, you check all your patch management reports and review everything, and those straggler machines, trying to make sure you account for all of those old Windows devices and check that they get the new patch, the emergency patch, and get it all documented properly to make sure you're doing that due diligence. That's still a lot of work, even if you don't have to actually do anything. Because of what's happened, you need to do your due diligence.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, but it's been a busy week with all of that going on, and we covered a lot of that in the last episode. And as things progress, I think we'll end up talking about it more. That may be the subject of the summer. So we'll see.
Yeah. Well, you know, they're already talking about another version that's getting ready to ramp up and get thrown out there. So, you know, the IT community at large, we're like, you know, trying to gather our resources and ammunition and, you know, shore up the bunkers and get ready for the attack.
The enemy's planning an attack, yeah, and we know
about
it.
To storm the beaches, and we want to make sure we have all the, you know, things
you
in place.
You don't want to be the Hessens at Valley Forge.
Oh, no, dude. I mean, it's just, I'm telling you, Monday was rough, because even though we were dealing with certain things and nobody got infected, but it's like every time the phone would ring, I would cringe. Like, please, please, please don't be an infected client.
That's the fortunate part. We didn't deal with any infections, but you know, we've got a lot of things in place that keep that from happening.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing.
We do too. However, as we talk about, is the people.
I know, really.
And as much as we watch over things and all that, we still every so often will have somebody who says, oh, by the way, you know, we picked up this killer deal on an XP laptop at a flea market, and it's been on our network for 2 months. And
that's why I'm starting to advocate doing a scan of the network every month, just to see what's out there.
Yeah,
because people are just too, you know, but we, you know what? One of the things we have to discuss today will actually point out that why people are doing that, because they think it's no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we have a special episode today where we're mostly talking about all the questions that have been coming into us, because our campaign to get questions has worked. and we had some that come in in emails, and we've had them come in the survey. We've had so many different methods, and even the SpeakPipe. So we've got a lot to cover, and it was it seemed like a good time to do listener questions.
Yeah. I like doing listener questions. It's fun.
I do too, because now we're interacting with them instead of just each other. And, well,
now we know we have listeners.
So let's get rolling, brother.
Yeah. So now I can prove it's not me that's, clicking on the episode 5,000 times a month to run up our listener count.
Yeah, David's doing 5,000 downloads. Yep, that's him.
Oh, boy. So do you have any places you're going you want to cover before we jump into this? Any engagements?
Well, let me tell you, because I haven't really, plugged this a lot, but I have started working with formedapproved.com as a new subject matter expert, and I'm in the midst of teaching a cybersecurity, be a cybersecurity officer professional in healthcare, and we're discussing understanding cybersecurity frameworks and how do you utilize the NIST CSF with HIPAA and the crosswalk to shore up your cybersecurity program and make it a formal cybersecurity program, not just a HIPAA security program. So you can look into that course. We've done two of the live workshop sessions this week, and we're doing two more next week, and they have scheduled later in the year, July, I want to say, to do another round of them. So check out what we're doing with formedapproved.com. I think we'll potentially do some other stuff. We're at least getting along while we're working together. So those guys have been good eggs. So shout out to Brian for all your help, and Brad, and
all the people.
Wendy, the one who approved paying the bill, so we'll go with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So anyway, and then, of course, I'm going to Valdosta in June with South Georgia MGMA and the Atlanta Association of Legal Administrators. That one I'm really excited about in July. And North Metro MGMA in Kennesaw, Georgia in October. And then I am doing the Georgia Association of Orthopedic Executives in November at Callaway Gardens. So, yay, I get to go hang out at the lodge. So there you have it. That's where I'm going to be for right now, along with some other stuff that is not public. It's private. It's where I do my private conversations.
Aha. Well, I'll be sitting right here.
Yeah, I know you will.
Before we jump into it, too, we need to remind people that we do have a survey we'd like for you guys to fill out. And we've had some good response on it, but we still need a lot more to get some feedback. But it's at helpmewithhipaa.com/survey. So head on over there. And we'll try to mention again at the end, but just in case I forget, I want to throw it in there now.
Well, now's a good time, since we're going to start with a question that came off of the survey.
So the first question that came in off the survey was about international HIPAA compliance. You've heard of that, right? So the question is... with family and caregivers being more remote and in other countries, how does HIPAA apply when the patient is in the U.S. and in other countries?
So, first of all, HIPAA is a U.S. law, so it can only be enforced when you're dealing with people and businesses and providers in the United States. Once you get outside the United States, things get a little different, because U.S. law doesn't apply in Canada or Spain or wherever you may travel.
Not yet.
Yeah, really. Yeah, sure. Everybody listen, do it our way. That goes over well. The only places, so if you're in another country, you're outside the U.S., and you contact providers and other payers and such that are doing business in the United States that are under HIPAA compliance, then you will follow the HIPAA rules about, patient care and who can access information and so on and so forth. But if you're in another country, and let's say that I did get to try socialized medicine in Germany when I was over there. I had a blister on my toe. Yeah, it was funny. I had to go into the little first aid station, and my brother had to remember what to call it. But then it was great. They put a Band-Aid on, and it stayed on forever. I wore it on.
You know, is your Band-Aid in a beer?
No, really? Hefeweizen and Plasta. But it was a great Band-Aid. It's cool. It stayed on longer than any of the ones I've ever put on
German
here.
German engineer Band-Aid.
There you go.
That's why I drive a German engineered car.
Now here you go on that car. But so if I were treated over there and I wanted to send the information over, they could send it over. And if I'm being treated over there and I want to get information from my provider in the United States, it's going to get a little bit more tricky. So if you're going to be in that position where you're going to be overseas for a period of time and you want your providers to be able to send your records anytime you may need them, you may want to make those arrangements or at least discuss it with the provider's office, because technically it's going to get really complicated for them to know what they can legally do, because they are supposed to be able to share it with another provider. But one of the assumptions is the other provider follows HIPAA rules, and they won't. But the other piece of that is, in other countries, their privacy rules are even stricter than ours. They have more strict privacy rules, more strict security rules in most cases. Now, it depends, of course, on where you're at. You know, I don't know that the Ukraine might have this as strict rules as they do in, say, Great Britain. So if you're going to be overseas for a period of time and you want your records, I suggest you take them with you or have them with you. But if you're going to bring records from overseas and put them back in, there shouldn't be any problem. You can authorize them to send the records, and they will take the records they get. The big question is, when you're overseas and you want information about the patients, the HIPAA is not translatable. Mm-hmm. It's barely translatable to English to some people. So, yes, it's kind of complicated, but if you're going, take your records with you or make sure you let your provider know, and especially if you have a chronic illness, let them know if you're going to be out of the country.
Great advice if I decide to go anywhere.
I know.
All right,
you might go to South Korea.
I looked at tickets. I don't know if I'll go or not. It's pretty expensive to get over there.
Yeah, it is.
But anyway, I might go anyway. Who knows? So that was a question that came in. It was anonymous, which means we will take anonymous questions. Mm-hmm. And we have some crazy ones come in sometimes, but anyway. So Karen, not so anonymous, asked a question. Now, she threw a lot of questions out there at us at one time, so I'm just going to throw all of them together.
Yeah, just read the whole email.
Let's do the whole thing, and then we'll just, we'll pigeon shoot them as we can.
Pigeon shoot them. All right, hit it.
So, question came in, and it's about keeping a list of computer usernames and passwords for the staff. Not to the EHR application, but to the computers themselves. So, her question was, and states, and I quote, "The old office manager did this, and her excuse was that it's the practice's computer, and she needed a list of all the usernames and passwords for all the equipment the practice owned so she could get into the systems if she needed to. The replacement manager, so the new person, feels that this is incorrect. The question is, what does HIPAA say about this? What is reasonable and appropriate? What would happen if an employee suddenly left? Could the IT company get info, the computers, and access the files with system admin access? And what is recommended about this?" So lots of questions about it. Yeah. But we'll take the first one, which is, what does HIPAA say about it?
Doesn't really say anything specific. It says do what's reasonable, appropriate in your environment and maintain security. And whoever logs into something, you should be tracking it. And you should have unique usernames and passwords for every user. So there is a downside to doing that. If you're logging in as somebody else and you're actually monitoring those logins, even at the Windows level, I'm not just talking about the EHR, which you're supposed to pay attention, then you could potentially have people log in as somebody else and do things on the network that you wouldn't be able to be sure who did it.
Right.
So I'm not a big fan of doing that because that's just leaving something open in a spreadsheet. If you feel that it is necessary to do it, then find another way to manage it instead of putting a spreadsheet in. But I recommend not doing that. The flip side of that is assuming that you are configured in a way where there is admin users and then users, which is the way it should be. I mean, even if, whether you have a Windows server, if you have a Windows server in place, then yes, the IT company can get to everything on those devices pretty much, unless somebody tried, you know, it would be kind of tricky. If they're doing what they're supposed to be doing on how those desktop machines or laptops are configured, then yes, they should be able to get to it and it's a whole lot easier, but you want to make sure that you ask them about it. If you don't have something like Active Directory taking care of all the machines, you want to have an admin password that you have, whoever sets up all the machines, set that up on every single machine so that the admin is a username and password that you know, and it's a standard for the company, potentially, just like it would be if you had Active Directory. And that is how then you're able to go back in and log in as the administrator, and then you can get to everything. That's my thoughts. What are yours, David?
The only thing I would add to that is, you know, you do need to find out what is reasonable and appropriate for your practice, just like you said. And there's definitely a lot of ways to skin this cat.
Yeah, I know, really.
So, and that's why when we read the question, Donna was like, wow, because it does, there's so many different ways to address this. There's no one way we can say this is what you should do. It's more like these are half a dozen ways you can do this. Pick one.
Yeah.
But even when you have something like, okay, an employee left suddenly, from an IT perspective, I don't really care if an employee leaves and doesn't give you the passwords because I don't care what Windows password you use, I can crack it. Mm-hmm. But and that's not a hacking thing. That's just IT tools that we use give us that ability.
We get around that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and that's why I always tell people, I don't care what how secure your Windows password is. If I can physically get to your machine, it doesn't do any good. I can bypass any password in 5 minutes or less.
Yeah. If somebody's in there messing around, though, as the administrator of the machine and they know what they're doing, there's some stuff they could get into that make it a little harder.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, you can get into that box.
Yeah, I'm based on the assumption that it's the average user.
Yeah, I know, really.
If you know that much, then you shouldn't be working.
There's a lot of these that you don't know what they know, and they really do know how to do that stuff. So keep an eye out for that.
This is true. So could your IT company keep the info or get the info? Yes, they could. Some IT companies will manage the passwords for you if you ask them to, or maybe they want to. I don't remember if it was the last podcast or one before that, but we recently had a discussion about this where, you know, do you want to give access to even your employees or yourself in the administrative level? Now, I'm a believer that I don't want to put myself in a position where I can hold a company hostage. So I do like giving them an administrative account, but I do like telling them, don't use it. But it's there in case something happens, it's there. Now, some IT companies are hell-bent on not doing this. They will not give you admin access to your own equipment because they don't want you going in there and messing up something that they then have to go in and fix, typically for free because it's somewhat included in their service. So they don't want you messing with stuff. So that's the conversation you're going to have with your IT provider. But can they do that as far as keeping your passwords? Yes. There are other ways you can do it. There are third-party escrow accounts where you can have passwords stored so that if something happens, you can still get access to those, but it's not something that's kept on a piece of paper or a spreadsheet. So,
yeah, so we don't want you to keep a spreadsheet. Let's just be clear. We don't want you to keep a spreadsheet of usernames and passwords for anything.
Yeah, tape to your monitor.
Yeah, we don't want you to do that. So let's be clear on the first part. No, we don't want you doing that. We do not want them to keep that. There are other ways to get there. Plus, you know, if it's just an employee, you don't want any employee to be the only one with access to anything. Yeah, you know, they shouldn't be storing stuff on the computer that they're the only ones that have access to it. If they're storing it on the servers, then you know they're not the only ones with access to it unless you've given them some sort of admin control. and they shouldn't have admin control. Mm-hmm. And even then, you know, there's the, remember the change in the admin password, and they asked for $200,000 consulting fee to give them the passwords.
Yeah.
So you do want to make sure that you've got that going on. So,
yeah. And you should never be running as an administrator anyway, although
as an administrator.
There are some apps that I run into that will not function unless
as administrator.
Yeah. So you have to be able to address all that. So there again, that's where you have to have a conversation with IT. But if you're running as an administrator, you're asking for problems. You're asking for problems to happen. Big problems.
Indeed.
So anything else on that one before we jump on to John Dubinsky?
Let's move on to John.
All right, cool. So John, in his high-tech self, because he is in IT, he used a SpeakPipe widget that we have on our website and left us a voice message, which we will listen to now.
Hi, Double Ds. This is John Dubinsky calling from the Maven Group. I have a quick question regarding voice over IP, VoIP phone systems, cloud-hosted versions, and internet faxing. My question is general. Any concerns with these services as related to HIPAA? Any clarity, resource, or brevity you can provide on these services in relation to compliance? Thanks for a great show, and I appreciate your time.
Okay, so first of all, Double D.
Yeah, I know. We enjoyed that. Thanks, John. We both are like, Double D.
Yeah, so I was like, yeah, I guess we are a couple of boobs. I don't know. But
at least we name it and claim it.
Yeah. So great question, John. Voice over IP, cloud hosted. Now, the funny thing about this is, and I know you remember this, Donna, that when all the HIPAA stuff started coming out, the voice over IP people, that's hard to say, were going, this does not apply to us. No way, no how. You can't make it. We're not doing it. I mean, they just were in an uproar about this.
They still are. Don't think that they're not. And actually, this is one of the things that, you know, we have some contacts at OCR, and I was talking with them at a seminar that we were at, and I'm telling them this, and the group of them are like, but, you know, I don't know what you mean. And so I sent it to them, and they had like a whole lawyer powwow on it, apparently. But the bottom line is, the biggest issue, and Devin McGraw mentioned that they are cleaning up their guidance on the website because some of it is very old. And one particular piece of guidance that's on the website says that voicemail is not PHI, mm-hmm. but that guidance was done in 2002.
Yeah.
And there's no way that it was talking about voicemail on a frickin', you know, landline kind of thing. It certainly wasn't talking about VoIP and you have a big server and all of it's integrated with the network. I mean, back then you had a, you know, you would have even, maybe there was a computer, but it wasn't integrated with the network. You couldn't get to it any other way than, hey, go to the telephone room, you know, and get in there and mess with that computer. And having it part of the network, and now I've got MP3s that I can email around everywhere. That, you've got a whole different ballgame there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I was explaining to them is, you know, I go into these sites where you've got the covered entity or business associate arguing with the provider of VoIP services saying, hey, because of this 2002-2003 guidance, HIPAA doesn't apply to me. That's BS. Because that's going to go away, I can assure you. And the lawyers, if you want to hang your hat on that, you need to move along. As far as I'm concerned, I'm not going to do business with you, because the lawyers are looking at it and saying, okay, look, you're going to hang your hat on that one little thing. All of these things in the law are going to override that. So, yeah. Yes, you do have to worry about it. You want it to make sure that you've got a business associate agreement in place with whoever's going to be doing it. There is a big issue as well when you talk about online faxes. And this one, it was like, wait, what? So you've got an online fax service and they will sign a BAA, but they will let you then say, forward my faxes to this email. Okay, well, that email is not secured.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now I've just gone outside of my whole... But you've given them the authority to do it. So they're like, hey, not my problem. You said do it. I did what you asked.
Yeah.
You
know, well, it's like a lot of
you're the one in charge of that email.
There are a lot of things out there that are like that, in that they'll say, yes, our company is HIPAA compliant. Yes, our product is HIPAA compliant. Then if you read the small print, it says, as long as you use it in a HIPAA compliant manner.
Yeah. Then I always love that.
Which is true, and that's true with everything that you're doing around this stuff, is that if you have to do it in a compliant manner. Otherwise, you circumvent everything that's put there to protect you and to be compliant.
Yeah. So what I recommend when it comes to any of that VoIP, whether you're doing a installed VoIP system or you're doing a cloud VoIP and you're going to do any kind, even if you're putting in a fax server, I recommend that you do a mini risk assessment where you take in and you say, here are the apps I'm going to use. How many ways can this information in the conversations, the voicemails, the faxes, how many ways can they get out of my control using these tools, and how can I secure them, and get that documented right up front, and make sure you have the BAAs in place and that you understand and do some level of due diligence that they actually understand what that means. Because David's right, they're finally giving in, but I think a lot of them may be taking the approach that everybody used to take with a BAA, is all I got to do is sign it and I don't really have to do the work.
Mm-hmm.
So very good question. And for tech people, we understand all of that. But I tell you what really brought it up and why I actually had the conversation at the seminar with the OCR folks had to do with the story that was told there, where it was talking about I think it was like a Wall Street firm or something, but somebody hacked into the VoIP system and listened to the voicemails between all of the higher-ups to figure out what stocks to short and buy and all of those kind of things. So, yeah, they figured out they can use it, and they're going to keep doing that. And when you have patients leaving voicemails telling very private things because they think, I'm not going to email this to you, I want it to be secure, so I'm going to leave you a voicemail. Yeah. So I'm just saying. And faxing should go away, but it's not going to anytime soon.
I know. I had a client call me the other week, and they were like, we can't fax something. I'm like, dude, people still use that?
Yeah. Thankfully, they don't have those thermal pages that go... Yeah. Yeah. So, thanks, John. And... yeah, thanks for being a loyal listener and proponent of Hip Me with HIPAA.
So that brings us to Amy's question. This is a pretty good one. It deals a little bit with, we don't really know what she's doing with it. I'll get to the question. After a consent is obtained, are we allowed to take pictures of patients and their beautiful babies with our phones? If so, can we email it to each other without their names or any other PHI listed?
So this one is, and Amy is clearly within obstetrics group. So babies are their business. And when people have their babies, they are very eager to show the babies off. And you know, it's special people that are involved in this because, you know, obstetrics, you're caring for the moms through the process, and so many things happen and so many things can go wrong. And when the baby gets there and the baby's healthy, or even if the baby's not, they're eager to share information with the entire staff that's been with them through the process. And I know you can recall that 9 months sounds like a long time. And then again, it's absolutely a very intense time that seems like it could have actually been 9 years. Some days are a year all by themselves. So it is something that is a common problem in obstetrics, especially even pediatrics, where people want to send pictures to the staff and to the office. So first of all, yes, you have to have a consent, but what the consent says is going to be key. Basically, are they just saying, here, you can throw this around, put it anywhere you want. You have complete authorization to do whatever you want with this. Or does the consent say you're allowed to send it in an unsecured method? Well, that still kind of implies you're going to do a certain level of protection beyond the unsecured method. So I'm sending it from one party to another that has the right to have it. I just don't have to securely send it. Maybe that's what the consent says. So you're going to have to really drill down into exactly what it's saying that you can do with it. And then another thing to note is that it is actually considered PHI if you have a front-facing photo. Remember what Abagnale said is, what was it he said? You needed to know your where you were born, that like the city you were born in, your date of birth, and a full facial picture, and he could become you. And the only thing that would be a limitation would be his imagination.
Yeah. And everybody puts pictures of themselves on social media.
Yeah. So a forward-facing picture is one of the ways that they are able to become you as an individual. I don't know that that necessarily is important as a baby, but a forward-facing picture is considered PHI because there's so much software out there now that does facial recognition. Mm-hmm. I mean, your own phone does it. There's so many of the phones now where you just look at the phone. They're trying to make it where you just hold it in front of your face and it logs you in.
Yeah, mine does that.
Yeah. So because of that, you have to remember that that is PHI. Just sending that alone is PHI. So it is a little tricky, but you know, if you're going to share those things, use I wouldn't necessarily. You need to do a risk analysis, but it would be something where you might want to consider using. Hey, I've got this picture, and I'm at least going to use a file sharing service where it doesn't have to be sent securely, but I'm not just tossing it around. So there you go. And I think that signed consent is good because you need to have that. But number one, what does it say? And number two, don't forget that likely that consent doesn't say you can just be willy-nilly with it.
Yeah. Well, she doesn't say exactly what they plan on doing with it other than can we email it to each other? But I'm assuming they're going to post it somewhere.
Well, a lot of times they just, they have multiple offices and somebody works in a different office, but they know the mom and they want to send it to them. And you don't want to give out the email address and phone number of the entire staff, So they're just wanting to get it to them and they sign a consent saying that you can. But also the posting is another piece that you do. Oh, you're authorized to post it on Facebook, but now I got to get it to the person that's authorized to update our page. So,
yeah. And that's, in my written response to her, that's why I suggested instead of having staff using their phones, which I'm assuming is happening, because I really don't want my pictures on anybody's phone that can just keep it there and.
Yeah, because you don't know what they're going to do with it.
Right.
Yeah.
So I don't want it to be on a staff person's phone, but I don't mind it being taken with a camera or phone that belongs to the practice that they, they'll take the picture and do whatever and then remove it from the device or whatever. So
yeah, that does become tricky.
Yeah. So what I suggested to her is that, get a device, an iPad or phone of some sort and, stick it on a tripod or whatever, but use that one device, take the pictures. That way the pictures aren't floating around to everybody's phones and then have one service that you can send it to. So you're not actually emailing it. You can upload it to that drive, Google Drive or Dropbox or whatever it is you use. And then you can give somebody a link to it and they can download it from there. So you're keeping it outside of the whole problem with email. It's still PHI. You still need to protect it. I don't care what kind of waiver they sign. I would still protect it. There's better ways to do it than just taking pictures with staff phones and just shooting it through their personal email accounts, which I know that probably ends up happening. I'm not saying
you're paranoid, David.
I'm not paranoid. I'm a realist. I've seen it happen. It's convenient. They're going to do what's convenient. And the convenient thing is I'm going to grab my phone and use my email to send this PHI, and that doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, there's a lot to consider in there. So it's not just, hey, you say it's okay for me to email this, so now I'm going to send it wherever I want. You got to be very specific about what you're going to do. And the whole BYOD thing is an issue. Bring your own device.
Gotcha. So.
You're right, David. Does that make you feel better? Does that make your day?
We'll get some shirts made to say that.
No, we will not.
I told you. Yeah. I told you that at the boot camp. We're going to get a shirt made.
David was right. Yeah. And then at the bottom it says one time.
One time. That's all it takes, man. I can ride that wave for a long time. I was wrong once too, but I got divorced, so there you go. I corrected that mistake. I digress. So yes. Next question that comes in is a very, very general question, which is Chromebooks. Is it okay to use them?
Yeah. Well, there was more to that, but I didn't want to dump that whole email in there. But the bottom line is, you know, we have a client that, especially with all this going on, they're looking at it. And you've certainly been very successful in using it outside of medical clients, but they're asking, hey, will we bless the use of them under HIPAA? And that was pretty much the question. So, and you have one, you love it. And so you want to talk about blessing it and why you would bless it or not bless it.
Yeah. So I bought one with the assumption that it would be something I would play with for a few hours or days and then give it to one of the kids. And I actually really like the thing. Now, the thing about Chromebooks is they're very similar to Android phones in that when you buy the cheap one, you'll hate it. And when you buy the good one, you'll like it. So I have to say that if you're going to buy one, don't buy the cheap one. Now, you don't have to spend a fortune on them, but if you're going to buy the $99 one, then you might as well save your money.
So what's a good one cost, the low end of a good one?
The one that I purchased was $285, which I still thought was a really good deal.
Yeah.
But that's the one I got. Now, there are ones out there that are more expensive. Some of them are as expensive as regular laptops.
Yeah, I don't understand that.
Yeah, I don't either. But I'll get back to the, you know, what's on the inside. You know, yeah. Are they running Intel i5s or i7s, which I don't really know why you need that much power to these things because they're pretty decent, even with low power. The main
reason. So your $285 one, you want to tell us what it is, or you want to not?
I would if I had divulge. It in front of me. it's an Acer Chromebook 14 is okay, what I bought.
There you go.
And the reason there's reason why I purchased this particular one had nothing to do with security and all that, but just to let you know, the reason why I bought it is because I wanted something that had a larger screen. I didn't want an 11-inch screen, so it has a 14 or 15 inch screen. It has 1080p, which I wanted that. And it had some external plugins that I wanted on it. And also, almost the number one thing was it had a 12 hour battery life usage. So I could use it for 12 continuous hours on one battery. So
I'm not going to ask what you were doing for 12 hours.
It's not what I'm doing. It's because my other laptop is a gaming laptop, and I get about an hour and 45 minutes to 2 hours, and I have to recharge it.
Wow.
So if I'm sitting on the couch and I'm typing articles or blogs or searching, whatever I'm doing, by the time I get through a show, I'm down to 25% battery life.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, crap, I got to plug it in. So I wanted something where I just had more battery life. But anyway, so I got the Chromebook. I really use it a lot more than I thought I would. It's very lightweight. It's very much akin to the MacBook Pro. Looks like one. You know, they kind of cloned it, I guess. But the thing about it from a security perspective is that because it's running a Chrome OS, which is not really like a Windows or Mac OS or anything like that, it's really running just a browser. And just out of the box, without doing anything to it, it is already a very, very secure product. There are other things that you can do that, you know, you can tweak some things to make the security even better, but it just already just an ultra secure computer just straight out of the box. And I like it for that reason.
So the question then came up, okay, when I said, hey, yeah, that probably wouldn't be a problem. As long as the websites you visit will work in Chrome. Mm-hmm. You know, if your required websites that you go to require Internet Explorer, you're falling off the wagon there. You're not divorcing yourself from Microsoft. Or Edge. I'm sorry. That's the new one.
Push your Edge.
Yeah. If it requires something besides Chrome, they're not going to be helpful.
Yeah. Now, there are, and I've not used them in a long time, but I know there are plugins out there that will open a website up in a Internet Explorer window, even though it's in Chrome. I haven't tried them in a while, but I know I used to have to do that with certain things when I ran Chrome and Firefox years ago, but it's gotten now to where almost everything works on Chrome, so I don't have to do that anymore. But I know there are some applications still out there. I still have clients that have to run things in Internet Explorer and Edge.
Yeah, that drives me crazy. I want to be able to use whatever browser I want to use.
Yeah.
But the reason that it's secure, because the question was, and here I go, I want to hear your answer because I already had to answer this, but if I go to a malicious website, one that we know would be on our Windows computer, could potentially launch ransomware or a virus of some sort, some malware. What makes it safe if I'm, you know, because you're telling me I don't have an antivirus, I don't have patches and all of that same level to worry about. Why would it be safe to use this in a medical office?
Okay. So going back to the Chromebook's default security and using the Chrome OS, it's essentially a Chrome browser. So it already benefits from Google's ongoing security efforts to identify malicious websites. And it has this sandbox, or how do I explain the sandbox? It segments each and every tab so that every tab is basically its own little environment. So there's nothing that can take down the whole computer. And even if you had something that were to happen to the Chromebook, it's very, very easy just to sign out of it and to redo the Chromebook in a matter of minutes and then sign back in and you're good to go. So they're very resilient in that regard. Now, I haven't went out to malicious sites to click on stuff and see what happens, but with everything, with every tab sandboxed and segmented from all the other stuff, then there's no way for anything to get cross-contaminated.
Well, and the other thing is that they, you know, most of those malware sites, they're running JavaScript or some other tool inside the browser that is trying to launch a Windows application.
Right.
Or use a Windows vulnerability that it's not going to find. It's not going to be there. Mm-hmm. Plus, those little devices, they're not designed for networking. They don't see the servers. They can't talk to the servers as far as I know, can they?
Unless there's, I've not tried to connect it to a server. I mean, I know you can go in there and connect it to, you know, a Wi-Fi account or something like that, but there's no physical connection. You can't plug a network cable into it, at least not the one I have. I don't think there's very much configuration you can do on that other than jumping onto a Wi-Fi network.
So you can't map a drive. You can't launch a connection to the servers pretty much through it. I mean, the whole reason to have it is that all you're going to do is access the internet on it.
Yeah.
And now, that's the only thing it can see. And so you can't launch the Windows programs that have the vulnerability so that it can attack other machines. You can't attack itself because they won't run those programs. And it doesn't even see your servers and your other programs, or at least right now. Now, there might be some other things we talk about doing, like that workspace thing. I don't know if that'll work.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll have an episode about that too, the workspace as a service, because we're looking into that too. But, you know, the whole caveat to this, though, is what we talked about earlier in the episode, which is as long as you use them in a manner that maintains the security, because I'm sure you could probably download something that will circumvent some of the things we're telling you that it's good at protecting you from. But the cool thing is if you go out there and say, you know, search for an antivirus app for Chrome, it's like, there's not one.
Right.
Which kind of got me going down the whole path initially of looking at one. It's like, wait a minute, why is there no antivirus for Chrome OS, and come to find out it doesn't need one.
Right. It's super easy to use if you live in the browser like a lot of us do now. It's super easy to use. So for me, you know, of course you have to do a security risk analysis and say, you document, here's what we're going to do and here's why we think it's okay. But in my opinion, it's easy to document that and you should be able to use it just fine if the things you need to do will all run in a Chrome browser.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kicker when you start getting in the medical environment. But I don't see it as a huge risk on any network to other machines. And, you know, a keylogger might be the only thing I could think that would really get you in trouble. And again, most of the time, those are launched using some other application, not something necessarily within the browser, although there are cases where things are within the browser. So you want to make sure you keep it up to date.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the other thing, too, is even though we're sitting here talking about it's secure and it doesn't need antivirus and all that, I do recall not that long ago, they said the same thing about Apple and MacBooks and all that. You know? So, you know, if you're in the hacking business or the malware business, then you're probably not going to waste your time writing a script to attack Chromebooks yet. It's just, you know,
there's not enough of them.
It's just not. Yeah. Honestly, probably the biggest buyer of Chromebooks in mass is the educational sector.
Yeah.
You know, all of the kids in our educational systems in our county, and I think probably all the surrounding counties that I can think of, they all have Chromebooks.
Yeah. I know the schools my nephews go to, they have it.
So. Yeah, which is really kind of a genius idea, because that means the next generation of kids are going to be buying Chromebooks because that's what they grew up on.
Well, that's what happened with Apple.
Yeah, you're right. Way back in the day.
Yeah. That's how I learned to work on them. So, but there you have it.
That's back before the Apple had a little chunk bitten out of it.
ba-dum-bump. Anyhow. But there you go. I would say that I am giving it the blessing as long as you're evaluating how you're going to secure it like you would any other device that you put on your network.
Right. Yep. Absolutely. So there's our questions. Good
ones. We do have a comment from Oliver, who sent us an email saying, ciao, Donna and David. But he was asking about putting the boot camp online. He can't make it to a boot camp, a live one,
yeah,
and wants to know about recording it. Please record it and put it online. So we did record it. We did have a professional cameraman there, and he hung out with us. In fact, Daniel was the one that pointed out, he was the first one to get an alert about the WannaCry happening in England. He said, hey, this is weird. I'm listening to you guys, and this popped up. So, you know, and we were like, hey, well, I'll have to look into that later. And the next thing you know, we're all getting told about it.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't decided, though. We did record it to give that raw video to
the
people who were attendees. And
thing about the video is that we didn't go into trying to record some of the questions that were coming in from the people that were there. So
we did a good effort, and Daniel tried really hard to get us to record everything properly.
Yeah.
And so we haven't seen it all yet. We certainly aren't going to make it available to those who were there. We may be able to, you know, I guess it's going to get down to what is the demand, you know, because we'll have to pay somebody to turn that into something to watch, I would think, you know, to be able to break it up and put it into pieces. We're going to have to pay somebody to do that. I don't have the time, and I know you don't have the time.
Or we can look at live streaming the next one instead of.
Well, that's your project. I ain't taking it on.
Well, instead of trying to sell access to, you know, what we put together, which we didn't really put it together with that intent to sell it or give access outside the group. So I don't know. We're thinking on the fly.
Yeah.
If you have anything you'd like to add, then email us.
Just had a vision of the two of us being shrunk. You know, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, riding a fly. So, I don't know where that came from.
It's that relapse of LSD from the 70s.
I was a wee child in the 70s. I did some things, just not that much. But anyway, so do know, Oliver, we are thinking about it and trying to decide about that. David's a big fan of live streaming, which would give you the same opportunity, but we got to figure out how to set that up and, you know, how to cover the cost and, you know, stroke a check. That's what I'm saying. So David's going to write a check to make sure that happens for you, Oliver. You can be the only one, and David's going to take care of you.
Could the Oliver stream.
It's the Oliver stream. There you go. So, but I think we don't even have time to get into the other little fill thing that I added for us, because I didn't think the questions would take that long. And as David predicted, we could rattle on about every question for a whole session. So,
yep. Right. So there again, David was right.
Mm-hmm.
Look for a shirt in a shop near you.
Well, I know I'm done with that.
So anyway, that's our questions for today. And I want to appreciate everybody who sent them in. Also, if you want to do that, you can email us at contact at helpmewithhipaa.com. You can also do like John did and visit the page at helpmewithhipaa.com and do it right there on the little SpeakPipe widget. Go to our survey, fill that out, helpmewithhipaa.com/survey. It won't take you but a minute, but you can also post questions there. But as we're asking you some things as a listener, you know, what are some things that we can do to make the show better and those types of things. So your feedback is very much appreciated and it will affect you in some way or another. So might want to give your opinion. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, so that's our show for today, folks. And remember, as always, HIPAA is not about compliance. It's about patient care.
You've been listening to the Help Me with HIPAA podcast, hosted by Donna Grendel and David Sims, the show created to help you with HIPAA. For more information or to ask us a question, visit our website at helpmewithhipaa.com. Neither Donna Grendel or David Sims are attorneys, and they do not offer binding legal advice concerning regulatory compliance. The information in this podcast should not be relied upon or construed as legal advice in any way. Consult your attorney for legal advice concerning compliance with HIPAA regulations.